Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting across from Anne Summers, who's come in to talk about her memoir, Unfettered and Alive. Welcome.
Thank you, John. Great to be here.
Now, one thing that's really clear from the outset is that this isn't your Tristram Shandy. It doesn't start with conception. It's not even a David Copperfield. It doesn't start with birth. You start bang in the middle with your memoir. You've just published...
Damned Whores and God's Police.
For all my book-selling life...
How could you forget it?
No. I get it wrong. I get it wrong every time. It's like some sort of problem in my brain where I have to pause and try to align them in the right way because I get it completely wrong.
A lot of people call it every time. God's Whores.
Yeah. It comes out because I've actually said it to customers as I'm in my shop and they've looked at me like I'm a madman. This book starts in the flow. So you've just published that. You've just taken a job with National Times and you're thrown straight into... this role as a journalist. The National Times was a different kind of newspaper. It was a bit of more of a long form paper, and it seemed to me that you got a pretty plum job straight up. Can you tell me a bit about that beginning part and why you chose to start with that in the book?
Well, I was 30 years of age, and I was really just I have written a previous book called Ducks on the Pond. That talked more about my earlier life, and that ended in 1975. And so I decided with this book, even though this book is very different, it's not really a sequel to Ducks on the Pond, it's its own book. But nevertheless, I decided that I would start at the age of 30 and I would just basically talk about my life as a grown-up. Mm-hmm. And, as I say in the first sentence of the book, that I thought I'd made it. I just published my first book and I just got a job as a real journalist. I was so incredibly happy and excited, and I guess I thought getting there, I'd got there, so that then I'd achieved everything. But in fact, that was just the beginning. Mm. And what you don't realise, I guess, when you're young, is that walking in the door is just the first step. It's certainly not the last step. It's not the destination. I was very, very fortunate going into journalism then at that time with that newspaper and with a fantastic editor, Max Such, who... Yeah, I thought it was a god. It turns out he wasn't that much older than me, but he had, he was a real journalist, knockabout journalist, and he'd recently become editor of the paper, and he just had an enthusiasm for stories, as they used to be called, and for reporting that was so infectious, and he really trained me as a journalist. So even though I wasn't a cadet and I didn't do all the traditional shipping news and town hall reports and all that stuff, thank goodness, I went straight into the deep end. But I was trained by somebody who really was the best. And it was a paper that was very unusual for that time. As you say, long-form articles, investigative articles. We had a lot of time to write our stories. We had bylines. I mean, bylines weren't that common in those days because they were seen as, being up yourself. If you didn't need to have your name on them. The story was what was important, not who wrote it. Yeah. But the National Times sort of pioneered a different style of journalism in Australia. It was more like what we came to associate with magazine, particularly American magazine journalism, rather than newspapers. Mm. And we pioneered not just new topics that the rest of the media didn't cover, but also new ways of writing about them. And I guess, the two big stories that I did in my time there, I was there for 4 years, in my very first year, I got put onto doing articles about New South Wales prisons. And there'd been incredible scandals in the prison system and there'd been riots and terrible things had happened. And the newspapers didn't cover this stuff because, it was considered, prisoners, crims, who cares? No one really cared. And so when I was able to do all this amazing investigative work and discover really what had happened inside these prisons in New South Wales and the way in which prisoners were beaten within an inch of their lives and treated, in the way you'd expect from a Stalinist gulag, not in New South Wales in the 1970s. And so I did 6 articles on prisons, and there was initially a lot of criticism of the National Times for doing this because the view of the Fairfax management at the time was, well, our readers don't want to know about this stuff. But in fact, they did want to know about it, and there was a Royal Commission in Prisons had just been established, and my articles were designed in part to put pressure on that Royal Commission to make sure they really looked into what was happening, and they did, thank God. So that was one really big story, and what was important about that was the fact that I had 6 big articles, each of them, several thousand words long, and so it was a very comprehensive account of what was happening in a particular area of society that people previously hadn't really covered. So, and it also gave voice to a lot of prisoners. I interviewed a lot of prisoners and former prisoners and had incredible access to people, and including some of the prison warders, screws as they were called. And so I was able to get first-hand accounts of beatings and things like that that weren't previously known. And then I guess the other story that I was very well known for, even though I didn't write it on my own, there were two other guys involved with me, Bruce Dannard and Bruce Hanford. We went up to the far north Queensland town of Ingham, where we'd heard there was this thing called trains, the Ingham trains.
Yeah, I couldn't, when I was reading this, I couldn't believe this existed.
Well, you know, it was extraordinary. I mean, we got the tip. We couldn't believe it existed either. And what it was basically is in the local, you know, dance on Saturday night, you know, a couple would be dancing. They might leave the hall where it was or the hotel. And the guys there would, you know, signal with their hands, this sort of yanking train signal, stopping a train. And the guys would follow the couple out, and as many as 50 guys, and they would get hold of the girl and they'd rape her. And the police could do nothing about it. The police had arrested a couple of people, nothing had happened. They'd always thrown out in court. It was a very tight-knit Italian community that had very traditional views about women, that, you know, women were sacred until you raped them, then they were sluts. And it was just, what was remarkable about the story itself was horrifying, but the way that we approached it was what made it very different form of journalism, because I wrote about the girls and the guys wrote about the boys. And it wasn't as if the two Bruces were taking the men's side so much, but they were getting their side of the story. And they actually got to interview the guy that led the trains. And he said, well, it's not like we rape these shearers or anything. They want it. You know, they want it. But he said, but all the girls in this town, they're all sluts. They're all sluts, yeah. And I interviewed the girls, and some, I mean, these were all middle-class girls, you know, the daughter of the bank manager, the daughter of the high school principal. And the parents of the town were completely cowed by what was happening because there was nothing they could do. So the story caused an absolute sensation. And it changed the way of writing about sex, because these sorts of things weren't written about except on the crime pages.
Yeah.
They weren't written about as sort of social phenomena that you should investigate. And I was able to bring to that writing some of the kind of observations and the ideas about women and the meaning of rape, which we were just starting to kind of really examine back in the 70s, starting to understand that rape was this expression of male power. I was able to bring that sensibility to the story. And so that made it very notable. And then I did another story very quickly, I think about a month later, with David Marr.
Yeah. This one was interesting as well, yes. The way you guys approached this.
Yeah, well, this is called The Animal Act of the Year. And this was at St. Paul's College, where not much seems to have changed over the years. But it was an annual ceremony whereby they awarded, the boys had this, you know, black tie dinner, men only, of course. And at the end of the dinner, they awarded a prize for what was decided was the Animal Act of the Year committed by one of their, you know, their number, and there would be nominations for it. And in this particular year, the person who won was a guy who had taken a whole lot of his mates into his girlfriend's bedroom at Women's College across the road, and they'd all had sex with her, and they had claimed it was consensual, and she had complained about it, but not to the police. She'd told some people at the time. This had happened some months earlier. But on the night that he got the Animal Act of the Year award, he was given a kind of a sex doll, and he started to simulate having sex with this doll, and somebody yelled out the girl's name. And so the girl found out that she'd been humiliated in this fashion, and she went to the SRC, which happened to be all run by women for the first time ever. There'd been a feminist coup there. And the president of the SRC got in touch with me, and I came down and interviewed them. But the way we did this, I interviewed the girl. I wrote about her. David Marr interviewed the boys, the four men who were involved, and who had been suspended from college, but that was sort of as far as that was going to go. There weren't going to be any penalties against them. And David believed then that it wasn't rape, and I believed the girl that it was. And so we sort of locked ourselves away in my apartment in Elizabeth Bay for about 3 days and yelled at each other about it and couldn't reach any reconciliation. So in the end we decided, well, okay, we'll tell it the way we see it. So it was a he said, she said story, and that's the way we wrote it. And so again, it was the story itself was really important and interesting and shocking, but it was also the way we told it, which made it a bit unusual.
This is also the period of new journalism where people are inserting themselves, journalists are inserting themselves yes. into the telling of it. What comes out when you read your book is, I mean, I have to read a lot of memoirs in the job, and there's a lot of distance in these stories often. Like, you don't feel like you're, it is something like an old person sitting back and going, well, in my day, you know, this doesn't feel like, this feels like I'm there. This has that really immediate feeling. And I feel like I'm going through those things, learning the ropes with you in those offices, and then taking all these crazy, like if you try to draw a plot of your life and the choices that you make, like, no novelist would touch you. You know, just like, no, that wouldn't happen. When you run down, the things that you did and the times you did them, it just seems, just when you seem to be, like, for one, you publish a book that sells extraordinarily well, and then you almost immediately take a job with National Times, and you do extraordinarily well in there, but you sort of just leave the book to do what the book does, and the book does what it does. It keeps going and becomes one of those, the milestones in Australian publishing that's just never really gone out of print. It just sits there. That with the Female Eunuch are the two big books of the 70s. But you just throw yourself into being a journalist, and you kind of cut ties with all that other part, even the work with the, your work with the feminists and there wasn't enough time. You sort of didn't have time to be part of all these groups and all these committees and the like. So you just had to sort of dump that and go down that path. And then you take a job overseas. Like, it just doesn't seem like, it seems like you just think there's a challenge. It seems terrifying. I'm going to go for that. Like, it just seems crazy. This way
we've never been able to turn down a good adventure.
Yes, it's such an amazing story to be reading, because you really don't know what Anne's going to do next. I mean, you turn up in the US and there you are handing over a check to get to take control of Ms. Magazine from Gloria Steinem, and then you run that and you. It becomes like, it's a massive, massive thing, and you're involved in the real center of the women's movement in the US, and the people you must meet in that time. What were the kind of the highlights in that little segment of your life, which is different to other segments of your life? But if we go to that segment, what are the highlights in your Ms. Magazine period?
Well, that was you know, probably one of the most extraordinary things I've ever done, and that was pure serendipity, I guess, that it even happened. I mean, how it all started was, I was already in New York working for Fairfax, and was sort of a bureau chief, North American bureau chief was my title, I think, and I was writing for the Financial Review, and there was the National Times had become the Times on Sunday, and I used to write a column for that, but I was just sort of drifting along and not really enjoying it very much, because it turned out it's very hard to be a foreign correspondent in America, if you come from a boring, reliable ally like Australia, because no one wants to talk to you because you're not interesting. And so it was very hard to get stories. I was finding that I was really thrilled to be in New York finally with the job, so I could afford to be there.
Because you'd been over before. And then
I'd been there plenty of times. And several times I'd flirted with the idea of staying there. And I'd never had a job, and I thought I was just too – I wasn't brave enough to do that then. And so I finally got this job, and I thought, wow, I'm set. And I was disappointed. So towards the end of 1987, Sandra Yates, who was running or second in charge of the magazine division of Fairfax magazines, called Sun Gravure, I think, back then, got the go-ahead from the company to come to New York to start a teenage girls magazine that would be modelled on Dolly, which, you know, phenomenally successful magazine. And she, you know, got enlisted me, and I was helping her find office space and, you know, setting things up. And one day she took me to lunch at a little cafe, that bistro around the corner from the Fairfax office, just off Times Square. And she said, well, doctor, everyone used to call me doctor, I've just discovered that Ms. Magazine is for sale. And she said, I'm going to get Fairfax to buy it and we're going to run it. I said, okay. And we did.
And so
that took about 6 weeks, and Fairfax, you know, paid the money, and we bought the magazine. We discovered it was in terrible shape and much more financially indebted than we'd realised, and a lot of things wrong with it. So it was a very, very tough business proposition and a very tough journalistic proposition, because and there's no kind of journalistic rigor. It was a very ideological magazine rather than, and it was failing. People were over that kind of way of talking about women. Women can do no wrong approach to things. And what I tried to do, and what I'd hoped to do with it, and in the end I didn't succeed, but what I'd hoped to do with it was to bring sort of my feminist sensibility, my journalistic experience, and my great curiosity for how women were doing in this incredibly huge country, interesting country of America, to the magazine, and really turn it into a must-read magazine. And unfortunately, it's too detailed to talk about here, but it's
you got a book about it.
Laid out in the book, The Many Misadventures of Anne at Ms. Magazine. But at the same time, what was extraordinary is, the way in which New York embraced us was wonderful. We were just suddenly so famous. And, our photos are in all the magazines. We're in Time Magazine, we're in New York Magazine, we're in New York Times, we're in everything. Everybody knew us. People would stop me in airports. I was immediately recognizable. Got invited to everything. And we're on all the A-lists, which was very, very exciting. And so, I got to meet lots of amazing people. Everybody who was anyone then, I probably met them at a party or at a dinner or at a seminar or whatever. And I also found... I had very mixed success. In ringing up writers, because I had my A-list of writers, I can't ring up Joan Didion and ask her if she'll cover the Democratic Convention for me. Why not?
Yeah.
And her agent sort of said, no, she's not writing about politics anymore. And then, a few months later, I was at the Democratic Convention and I met Joan Didion at a party. And I said, oh, what are you doing here? She said, I'm covering the convention. I said, I thought you weren't writing about politics anymore. She said, what on earth gave you that idea?
Oh, God.
So it was obvious that she didn't want to write for Ms. Because nobody did, because the reputation of the magazine was great in feminist circles but pretty bad everywhere else. So what I found, I got very frustrated that I couldn't get people like her. And Susan Sontag was somebody else I asked, and she just looked at me like I was insane. That's what she wanted to write for Ms. But against that, I was able to persuade lots of other great writers. And I did have Maya Angelou wrote something for me in one issue. And, lots of other really well-known writers used to sort of, come in and do things. So that part of it was great. But the overriding part of that story was that even though Gloria Steinem had sold the magazine, she couldn't really leave. And, it was too much part of her. And she was so identified with it that, I say to people, like the editor of Ms. Magazine, they say, no, Gloria Steinem is. I said, well, in fact, she never has been. She was never the editor. But she was so associated with it in the public eye that I never really had a chance of supplanting her. And we ran into financial problems very early on in our business. First of all, we'd only had been in business for about 3 or 4 months, I think. Just starting Mears and the first issue of Sassy was just about to come out when Sassy was the teenage girls magazine that's modeled on Dolly, called Sassy. Young Warwick Fairfax, threw the spanner in the works of Fairfax, launched the privatisation bid and we were sold. And that's when Sandra said to me, well, we're going to buy these magazines ourselves. And we did. So we raised $20 million on Wall Street and bought them.
We've only got a short period in this podcast, but we can't even that is a story in its own. You're just right. If you did that as anybody, you'd write your own memoir about that part of the life. Then you had your political time with Hawke and Keating. Then later on, you sort of jumped the gun Misogyny Factor, and then Julia Gillard's Misogyny Speak, and conversations with Julia Gillard as well. You seem to pop up in these important moments in the last 30 years, 40 years of Australian history, as well. This book is not only a memoir of your life, but it's also a sort of a history of those times.
Of the era. I wanted it to be a social history with me as a principal character, not always a main character, but I'm always there, obviously. Yeah. I'm writing about things that I've been there for and I've witnessed, I've experienced. I don't write about things that happened, outside of my experience. But I didn't want it to all be about me, because I wanted to see, I see myself as an observer and as a participant, obviously, but I wanted to be able to tell a story of that era, or that particular place where I was, where I was working for Paul Keating at the PMI, which was one of the most exciting jobs I've ever had, and which was, and I love that chapter of the book, and hope other people will too. You know, suddenly I'm running Greenpeace. I mean, that was a whole new thing for me to do, but it was a chance then to talk about Greenpeace and what it was like, because I didn't really know much about Greenpeace, and I'm assuming most people don't. You know, you have your images of boats and dreadlocks and all the rest of it, but you know, in fact, it was a very sophisticated campaigning organisation, which has made some extraordinarily important changes in the world. So I just saw it as telling the story of the kind of key political and social events of that past 40 years, that the ones that I've had the privilege to be connected with in one way or another, and to give giving a bit of history as well as my personal story.
Well, it's a beautifully written book, and as I said, so immediate that you do feel like you're getting a close close view, insider's view to that period. Thank you so much for coming and talking to Sam.
Pleasure, John. Thank you so much for having me.
And you can get hold of Anne Summers' Unfettered and Alive, a memoir, at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.